An ill wind is all. A wind drove her too far to the south. And who set the wind? Salar, the mother, spoke to me.
The old Iceni blinked at him.
Your mother is dead. The mother. She blessed me with 7 sons, and yet I let them burn her. She spoke to me. We call the fire, she said. We call the shadows, too. I rode Melisande into the bowels of Storm's End and watched her birth a horror.
He saw it still in his nightmares, the gaunt black hands pushing against her thighs as it wriggled free of her swollen womb.
She killed Cressin and Lord Renly and a brave man named Courtney Penrose, and she killed my sons as well. Now it is time someone killed her.
Someone? Said Salador San. Yes, just so, someone, but not you. You are weak as a child and a warrior. Stay, I beg you, we will talk more and you will eat, and perhaps we will sail to Braavos and hire a faceless man to do this thing, yes? But you, no, you must sit and eat.
He is making this much harder, thought Davos wearily, and it was perishingly hard to begin with. I have a vengeance in my belly, Sala. It leaves no room for food. Let me go now, for our friendship. Wish me luck, and let me go.
Salador San pushed himself to his feet.
You are no true friend, I am thinking. When you are dead, who will be bringing your ashes and bones back to your lady wife, eh? And telling her that she has lost a husband and 4 sons? Only sad old Salador San. But so be it, brave Sir Knight. Go rushing to your grave. I will gather your bones in a sack and bring them to the sons you leave behind to wear in little bags around their necks, eh?
He waved an angry hand with rings on every finger.
Go! Go, 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 go!
Davos did not want to leave like this.
Salar, go, or stay better, but if you are going, go.
He went. His walk up from the bountiful harvest to the gates of Dragonstone was long and lonely. The dockside streets where soldiers and sailors and small folk had thronged were empty and deserted. Where once he had stepped around squealing pigs and naked children, rats scurried. His legs felt like pudding beneath him. And thrice the coughing racked him so badly that he had to stop and rest. No one came to help him, nor even peered through a window to see what was the matter. The windows were shuttered, the doors barred, and more than half the houses displayed some mark of mourning.
Thousands sailed up the Blackwater Rush, and hundreds came back, Davos reflected. My sons did not die alone. May the mother have mercy on them all.
When he reached the castle gates, he found them shut as well. Davos pounded on the iron-studded wood with his fist. When there was no answer, he kicked at it again and again. Finally, a crossbowman appeared atop the barbican, peering down between 2 towering gargoyles.
Who goes there?
He craned his head back and cupped his hands around his mouth.
Sir Davos Seaworth, to see his grace. Are you drunk? Go away and stop that bounding.
Salador San had warned him. Davos tried a different tack.
Send for my son, then. Devon, the king's squire.
The guard frowned.
Who did you say you were?
Davos,
he shouted.
The Onion Knight.
The head vanished to return a moment later.
Be off with you. The Onion Knight died on the river. His ship burned.
His ship burned, Davos agreed. But he lived, and here he stands. Is Jate still captain of the gate?
Who?
Jate Blackberry. He knows me well enough.
I never heard of him. Most like he's dead.
Lord Chittering, then.
Oh, that one, I know. He burned on the Blackwater.
Hookface Will, Hal the Hug.
Dead and dead,
the crossbowman said, but his face betrayed a sudden doubt.
You wait there.
He vanished again. Davis waited.
Gone. All gone, he thought dully, remembering how Fat Hal's white belly always showed beneath his grease-stained doublet, the long scar the fishhook had left across Will's face, the way Jade always doffed his cap at the women, be they 5 or 50, high-born or low.
Drowned or burned, with my sons and 1,000 others, gone to make a king in hell.
Suddenly the crossbowman was back.
Go round to the sally port, and they'll admit you.
Davis did as he was bid. The guards who ushered him inside were strangers to him. They carried spears, and on their breasts they wore the fox and flowers sigil of House Florent. They escorted him not to the stone drum, as he'd expected, but under the arch of the dragon's tail and down to Aegon's garden.
Wait here,
the sergeant told him.
Does His Grace know that I've returned? Asked Davis.
Bugger all if I know. Wait, I said.
The man left, taking his spearman with him. Aegon's garden had a pleasant piney smell to it, and tall dark trees rose on every side. There were wild roses as well, and towering thorny hedges, and a boggy spot where cranberries grew.
Why have they brought me here? Davis wondered.
Then he heard a faint ringing of bells, and a child's giggle, and suddenly the fool, Patchface, popped from the bushes, shambling along as fast as he could go, with Princess Shireen hot on his heels.
"You come back now!" she was shouting after him. "Patches, you come back!"
When the fool saw Davis, he jerked to a sudden halt, the bells on his antlered tin helmet going ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling. Hopping from one foot to the other, he sang,
"Fool's blood, king's blood, blood on the maiden's thigh, but chains for the guests and chains for the bridegroom, aye."
Shireen almost caught him then, but at the last instant he hopped over a patch of bracken and vanished among the trees. The princess was right behind him. The sight of them made Davis smile. He had turned a cuff into his gloved hand, when another small shape crashed out of the hedge, and bowled right into him, knocking him off his feet. The boy went down as well, but he was up again almost at once. "What are you doing here?" he demanded, as he brushed himself off. Jet-black hair fell to his collar, and his eyes were a startling blue. "You shouldn't get in my way when I'm running."
"No," Davis agreed, "I shouldn't."
Another fit of coughing seized him as he struggled to his feet.
"Are you unwell?"
The boy took him by the arm and pulled him to his feet.
"Should I summon the maester?"
Davis shook his head.
"A cuff. It will pass."
The boy took him in his word.
"We were playing monsters and maidens," he explained. "I was the monster. It's a childish game, but my cousin likes it. Do you have a name?"
"Sir Davis Seaworth."
The boy looked him up and down dubiously.
"Are you certain? You don't look very knightly."
"I am the Knight of the Onions, my lord."
The blue eyes blinked.
"The one with the black ship."
"You know the tale?"
"You brought my uncle Stannis fish to eat before I was born, when Lord Tyrell had him under siege."
The boy drew himself up tall.
"I am Edric Storm," he announced, "King Robert's son."
"Of course you are." Davis had known that almost at once.
The lad had the prominent ears of a Florent, but the hair, the eyes, the jaw, the cheekbones, those were all Baratheon.
"Did you know my father?"
Edric Storm demanded.
"I saw him many a time, while calling on your uncle at court, but we never spoke."
"My father taught me to fight," the boy said proudly. "He came to see me almost every year, and sometimes we trained together. On my last name day, he sent me a war hammer just like his, only smaller. They made me leave it at Storm's End, though. Is it true my Uncle Stannis cut off your fingers?"
"Only the last joint. I still have fingers,
only shorter.
Show me. Davis peeled his glove off. The boy studied his hand carefully. He did not shorten your thumb?
No, Davis coughed. No, he left me that.
He should not have chopped any of your fingers, the lad decided. That was ill done.
I was a smuggler.
Yes, but you smuggled him fish and onions.
Lord Stannis knighted me for the onions and took my fingers for the smuggling.
He pulled his glove back on.
My father would not have chopped your fingers.
As you say, my lord. Robert was a different man than Stannis, true enough. The boy is like him, aye, and like Renly as well.
That thought made him anxious. The boy was about to say something more when they heard steps. Davis turned. Sir Axel Florent was coming down the garden path with a dozen guards in quilted jerkins. On their breasts they wore the fiery heart of the Lord of Light.
Queen's men, Davis thought.
A cough came on him suddenly. Sir Axel was short and muscular, with a barrel chest, thick arms, bandy legs, and hair growing from his ears. The Queen's uncle, he had served as Castellan of Dragonstone for a decade, and had always treated Davis courteously, knowing he enjoyed the favour of Lord Stannis. But there was neither courtesy nor warmth in his tone as he said,
"Sir Davis, an undrowned. How can that be?" "Onions float, sir. Have you come to take me to the king?"
"I've come to take you to the dungeon."
Sir Axel waved his men forward.
"Seize him, and take his dirk. He means to use it on our lady."
Jamie. Jamie was the first to spy the inn. The main building hugged the south shore where the river bent, its long low wings outstretched along the water as if to embrace travellers sailing downstream. The lower story was grey stone, the upper whitewashed wood, the roof slate. He could see stables as well, and an arbour heavy with vines. No smoke from the chimneys, he pointed out as they approached, nor lights in the windows.
"The inn was still open when last I passed this way," said Sir Cleos Frey. "They brewed a fine ale. Perhaps there's still some to be had in the cellars." "There may be people," Brian said, "hiding or dead."
"Frightened of a few corpses, wench," Jamie said. She glared at him.
"My name is
Brian, yes."
"Wouldn't you like to sleep in a bed for a night, Brian? We'd be safer than on the open river, and it might be prudent to find what's happened here."
She gave no answer, but after a moment she pushed at the tiller to angle the skiff in toward the weathered wooden dock. Sir Cleos scrambled to take down the sail. When they bumped softly against the pier, he climbed out to tie them up. Jamie clambered after him, made awkward by his chains. At the end of the dock, a flaking shingle swung from an iron post, painted with the likeness of a king upon his knees, his hands pressed together in a gesture of fealty. Jamie took one look and laughed aloud.
"We could not have found a better inn." "Is this some special place?"
the wench asked suspiciously. Sir Cleos answered,
"This is the inn of the Kneeling Man, my lady. It stands upon the very spot where the last king in the north knelt before Aegon the Conqueror to offer his submission. That's him on the sign, I suppose."
Torrhen had brought his power south after the fall of the two kings on the Field of Fire, said Jamie. But when he saw Aegon's dragon and the size of his host, he chose a path of wisdom and bent his frozen knees. He stopped at the sound of a horse's whinny.
"Horses in the stable. One, at least. And one is all I need to put the wench behind me."
"Let's see us home, shall we?"
Without waiting for an answer, Jamie went clinking down the dock, put a shoulder to the door, shoved it open, and found himself eye to eye with a loaded crossbow. Standing behind it was a chunky boy of 15.
"Lion, fish, or wolf?"
the lad demanded. We were hoping for Capon. Jamie heard his companions entering behind him. The crossbow is a coward's weapon.
It'll put a bolt through your heart all the same.
Perhaps, but before you can wind it again, my cousin here will spill your entrails on the floor.
Don't be scaring the lad now, Sir Cleo said. We mean no harm, the wench said, and we have coin to pay for food and drink.
She dug a silver piece from her pouch. The boy looked suspiciously at the coin, and then at Jamie's manacles.
Why is this one in irons?
Killed some crossbowman, said Jamie. Do you have ale?
Yes, the boy lowered the crossbow an inch. Undo your sword belts and let them fall, and might be we'll feed you.
He edged around to peer through the thick, diamond-shaped window panes and see if any more of them were outside.
That's a tully sail. We come from River Run, Brian undid the clasp on her belt and let it clatter to the floor.
Sir Cleos followed suit. A sallow man with a pucked, doughy face stepped through the cellar door, holding a butcher's heavy cleaver.
See, aye, we got horse meat enough for three. The horse was old and duff, but the meat still fresh.
Is there bread? Asked Brian.
Hard bread and stale oat cakes.
Jamie grinned.
Now, there's an honest innkeep.
They all serve you stale bread and stringy meat, but most don't own up to it so freely.
I'm no innkeep. I buried him out back with his women.
Did you kill them?
Would I tell you if I did?
The man spat.
Likely it were wolves' work, or maybe lions. What's the difference? The wife and I found them dead. The way we see it, this place is ours now.
Where is this wife of yours? Sir Cleos asked. The man gave him a suspicious squint.
And why will you be wanting to know that? She's not here. No more than you three will be, unless I like the taste of your silver.
Brian tossed the coin to him. He caught it in the air, bit it, and tucked it away.
She's got more, the boy with a crossbow announced.
So she does, boy. Go down and find me some onions.
The lad raised the crossbow to his shoulder, gave them one last sullen look, and vanished into the cellar.
Your son? Sir Cleos asked.
Just a boy the wife and me took in. We had two sons, but the lions killed one, and the other died of the flux. The boy lost his mother to the bloody mummers. These days a man needs someone to keep watch while he sleeps.
He waved the cleaver at the tables.
Might as well sit.
The hearth was cold, but Jamie picked the chair nearest the ashes and stretched out his long legs under the table. The clink of his chains accompanied his every movement. An irritating sound. Before this is done, I'll wrap these chains around that wench's throat. See how she likes them then. The man, who wasn't an innkeep, charred three huge horse steaks and fried the onions in bacon grease, which almost made up for the stale oatcakes. Jamie and Cleos drank ale, Brian a cup of cider. The boy kept his distance, perching atop the cider barrel with his crossbow across his knees, cocked and loaded. The cook drew a tankard of ale and sat with them.
"What news from River Run?"
he asked Sir Cleos, taking him for their leader. Sir Cleos glanced at Brian before answering.
Lord Hoster is failing, but his son holds the fords of the Red Fork against the Lannisters. There have been battles.
Battles everywhere. Where are you bound, sir?
King's Landing.
Sir Cleos wiped grease off his lips. Their host snorted.
Then you're three fools. Last I heard, King Stannis was outside the city walls. They say he has 100,000 men and a magic sword.
Jamie's hands wrapped around the chain that bound his wrists, and he twisted it taut, wishing for the strength to snap it in two.
Then I'd show Stannis where to sheathe his magic sword.
I'd stay well clear of that King's Road if I were you,
the man went on.
It's worse than bad, I hear. Wolves and lions both, and bands of broken men preying on anyone they can catch.
Vermin, declared Sir Cleos with contempt. Such would never dare to trouble armed men.
Begging your pardon, sir, but I see one armed man travelling with a woman and a prisoner in chains.
Brian gave the cook a dark look. The wench does hate being reminded that she's a wench, Jamie reflected, twisting at the chains again. The links were cold and hard against his flesh, the iron implacable. The manacles had chafed his wrists raw.
I mean to follow the trident to the sea, the wench told their host. We'll find mounts at Maidenpool and ride by way of Duskendale and Rusby. That should keep us well away from the worst of the fighting.
Their host shook his head.
You'll never reach Maidenpool by river. Not 30 miles from here, a couple of boats burned and sank, and the channel's been silting up around them. There's a nest of outlaws there, preying on anyone tries to come by, and more of the same downriver, around the Skipping Stones and Red Deer Island. And the Lightning Lord's been seen in these parts as well. He crosses the river wherever he likes, riding this way and that way, never still.
And who is this Lightning Lord? Demanded Sir Cleos Bray.
Lord Beric, as it please you, sir. They call him that, cos he strikes so sudden, like lightning from a clear sky. It said he cannot die.
They all die when you shove a sword through them, Jamie thought. Does Thoros of Myr still ride with him?
Aye, the Red Wizard. I've heard tell he has strange powers.
Well, he had the power to match Robert Baratheon drink for drink, and there were few enough who could say that. Jamie had once heard Thoros tell the king that he became a red priest because the robes hid the wine stain so well. Robert had laughed so hard he'd spit ale all over Cersei's silken mantle. "Far be it from me to make objection," he said, "but perhaps the trident is not our safest course."
"I'd say that's so,"
the cook agreed.
"Even if you get past Red Deer Island and don't meet up with Lord Beric and the Red Wizard, there's still the Ruby Ford before you. Last I heard, it was the Leech Lord's wolves held the ford, but that was some time past. By now, it could be lions again, or Lord Beric, or anyone."
"Or no one," Brian suggested.
"If my lady cares to wager a skin on that, I won't stop her. But if I was you, I'd leave this here river cut overland. If you stay off the main roads and shelter under the trees of a night, hidden, as it were, well, I still wouldn't want to go with you. But you might stand a mummer's chance."
The big wench was looking doubtful. "We would need horses." "There are horses here," Jamie pointed out. "I heard one in the stable."
"Aye, there are,"
said the innkeep, who wasn't an innkeep.
"Three of them, as it happens, but they're not for sale."
Jamie had to laugh. "Of course not, but you'll show them to us anyway." Brian scowled. But the man who wasn't an innkeep met her eyes without blinking, and after a moment, reluctantly, she said, "Show me," and they all rose from the table. The stables had not been mucked out in a long time from the smell of them. Hundreds of fat black flies swarmed amongst the straw, buzzing from stall to stall, and crawling over the mounds of horse dung that lay everywhere. But there were only the three horses to be seen. They made an unlikely trio, a lumbering brown plough horse, an ancient white gelding blind in one eye, and a knight's palfrey,
Dapple Grey, and Spirited.
They're not for sale at any price,
their alleged owner announced. How did you come by these horses? Brian wanted to know.
The dray was stabled there when the wife and me come on the inn,
the man said.
Along with the one you just ate, the gelding come wandering up one night, and the boy caught the palfrey running free, still saddled and bridled. Here, I'll show you.
The saddle, he showed them, was decorated with silver inlay. The saddle-cloth had originally been checkered pink and black, but now it was mostly brown. Jamie did not recognize the original colors, but he recognized bloodstains easily enough. Well, her owner won't be coming to claim her any time soon. He examined the palfrey's legs, counted the gelding's teeth. Give him a gold piece for the grey, if he'll include the saddle, he advised Brian. A silver for the plough horse. He ought to pay us for taking the white off his hands.
Don't speak discourteously of your horse, sir. The wench opened the purse Lady Catlin had given her and took out 3 golden coins. I will pay you a dragon for each.
He blinked and reached for the gold, then hesitated and drew his hand back.
Oh, I don't know. I can't ride no golden dragon if I need to get away. Nor eat one if I'm hungry.
You can have our skiff as well, she said. Sail up the river or down as you like.
Let me have a taste of that gold.
The man took one of the coins from her palm and bit it.
Real enough, I'd say. 3 dragons and the skiff.
He's rubbing you blind, wench, Jamie said amiably.
I want provisions, too, Brian told their host, ignoring Jamie. Whatever you have that you can spare.
There's more oatcakes.
The man scooped the other 2 dragons from her palm and jingled them in his fist, smiling at the sound they made.
Aye, and smoked salt fish. That will cost you silver. My beds will be costing as well. You'll be wanting to stay the night.
No, Brian said at once. The man frowned at her.
Woman, you don't want to go riding at night through strange country on horses you don't know. You like to blunder into some bug or break your horse's leg.
The moon will be bright tonight, Brian said. We'll have no trouble finding our way.
Their host chewed on that.
If you don't have the silver, might be some coppers would buy you them beds, and a coverlet or 2 to keep you warm. It's not like I'm turning travellers away, if you get my meaning.
That sounds more than fair, said Sir Cleos.
The coverlet is fresh washed, too. My wife saw to that before she had to go off. Not to flee to be found, neither. You have my word on that.
He jingled the coins again, smiling. Sir Cleos was plainly tempted.
A proper bed would do us all good, milady, he said to Brian. We'd make better time on the morrow, once refreshed.
He looked to his cousin for support. No, cuz, the wench is right. We have promises to keep and long leagues before us. We ought to ride on.
But, said Cleos, you said yourself.
Then, when I thought the inn deserted. Now I have a full belly, and a moonlight ride will be just the thing. He smiled for the wench. But unless you mean to throw me over the back of that plough horse like a sack of flour, someone had best do something about these irons. It's difficult to ride with your ankles chained together. Brian frowned at the chain. The man who wasn't an innkeep rubbed his jaw.
There's a smithy round back of the stable.
Show me, Brian said.
Yes, said Jamie, and the sooner the better. There's far too much horse shit about here for my taste. I would hate to step in it.
He gave the wench a sharp look, wondering if she was bright enough to take his meaning.
He hoped she might strike the odds of his wrist as well, but Brian was still suspicious. She split the ankle chain in the center with a half-dozen sharp blows from the smith's hammer delivered to the blunt end of a steel chisel. When he suggested that she break the wrist chain as well, she ignored him.
6 miles downriver, you'll see a burned village,
their host said, as he was helping them saddle the horses and load their packs. This time he directed his counsel at Brian.
The road splits there. If you turn south, you'll come to Sir Warren's stone tower house. Sir Warren went off and died, so I couldn't see who holds it now, but it's a place best shunned. You'd do better to follow the track through the woods south by east.
Ah, we shall, she answered. You have my thanks.
More to the point, he has your gold. Jamie kept the thought to himself. He was tired of being disregarded by this huge, ugly cow of a woman. She took the plough horse for herself and assigned the palfrey to Sir Cleus. As threatened, Jamie drew the one-eyed gelding, which put an end to any thoughts he might have had of giving his horse a kick and leaving the wench in his dust. The man and the boy came out to watch them leave. The man wished them luck and told them to come back in better times, while the lad stood silent, his crossbow under his arm. "Take up the spear or maul," Jamie told him. "They'll serve you better." The boy stared at him distrustfully. "So much for friendly advice." He shrugged, turned his horse, and never looked back. Sir Cleus was all complaints as they rode out, still in mourning for his lost feather bed. They rode east along the bank of the moonlit river. The Red Fork was very broad here, but shallow, its banks all mud and reeds. Jamie's mount plodded along placidly, though the poor old thing had a tendency to want to drift off to the side of his good eye. It felt good to be mounted once more. He had not been on a horse since Rob Stark's archers had killed his destrier under him in the Whispering Wood. When they reached the Burn village, a choice of equally unpromising roads confronted them. Narrow tracks, deep rutted by the carts of farmers hauling their grain to the river. One wandered off towards the southeast and soon vanished amidst trees they could see in the distance, while the other, straighter and stonier, arrowed due south. Brian considered them briefly, and then swung her horse onto the southern road. Jamie was pleasantly surprised. It was the same choice he would have made.
"But this is the road the innkeep warned us against," Sir Cleus objected.
"He was no innkeep."
She hunched gracelessly in the saddle, but seemed to have a sure seat nonetheless.
"The man took too great an interest in our choice of route. And those woods, such places, are notorious haunts of outlaws. He may have been urging us into a trap."
"Clever wench," Jamie smiled at his cousin. "Our host has friends down that road, I would venture, the ones whose mounts gave that stable such a memorable aroma."
"He may have been lying about the river as well, to put us on these horses," the wench said. "But he could not take the risk. There will be soldiers at the Ruby Ford and the crossroads."
"Well, she may be ugly, but she's not entirely stupid."
Jamie gave her a grudging smile. The ruddy light from the upper windows of the stone tower house gave them warning of its presence a long way off, and Brian led them off into the fields. Only when the stronghold was well to the rear did they angle back and find the road again. Half the night passed before the wench allowed that it might be safe to stop. By then all three of them were drooping in their saddles. They sheltered in a small grove of oak and ash beside a sluggish stream. The wench would allow no fire, so they shared a midnight supper of stale oat cakes and salt fish. The night was strangely peaceful. The half-moon sat overhead in a black felt sky surrounded by stars. Off in the distance, some wolves were howling. One of their horses whickered nervously. There was no other sound. "The war has not touched this place," Jamie thought. He was glad to be here, glad to be alive, glad to be on his way back to Circe. "I'll take the first watch," Brian told Sir Cleus, and Frey was soon snoring softly. Jaime sat against the bole of an oak, and wondered what Circe and Tyrion were doing just now. "Do you have any siblings, my lady?" he asked. Brian squinted at him suspiciously. "No, I was my father's only child." Jaime chuckled. "Son, you meant to say. Does he think of you as a son? You make a queer sort of daughter, to be sure." Wordless, she turned away from him, her knuckles tight on her sword hilt. What a wretched creature this one is. She reminded him of Tyrion in some queer way, though at first blush two people could scarcely be more dissimilar. Perhaps it was that thought of his brother that made him say, "I did not intend to give offence, Brienne. Forgive me." "Your crimes are past forgiving, Kingslayer." "That name again!" Jaime twisted idly at his chains. "Why do I enrage you so? I've never done you harm, that I know of." "You've harmed others. Those you were sworn to protect. The weak, the innocent." "The king?" It always came back to Aerys. "Don't presume to judge what you do not understand, wench." "My name is Brienne, yes. Has anyone ever told you you're as tedious as you are ugly?" "You will not provoke me to anger, Kingslayer." "Oh, I might, if I cared enough to try." "Why did you take the oath?" she demanded. "Why don the white cloak, if you meant to betray all it stood for?" "Why?" What could he say that she might possibly understand? "I was a boy, 15. It was a great honour for one so young." "That is no answer," she said scornfully. "You would not like the truth." He had joined the king's guard for love, of course. Their father had summoned Circe to court when she was 12, hoping to make her a royal marriage. He refused every offer for her hand, preferring to keep her with him in the Tower of the Hand while she grew older and more womanly and ever more beautiful. No doubt he was waiting for Prince Viserys to mature, or perhaps for Rhaegar's wife to die in childbed. Elia of Dorne was never the healthiest of women. Jaime, meantime, had spent 4 years as squire to Sir Sumner Crakehall, and earned his spurs against the Kingswood Brotherhood. But when he made a brief call at King's Landing on his way back to Casterly Rock, chiefly to see his sister, Circe took him aside and whispered that Lord Tywin meant to marry him to Lysa Tully, had gone so far as to invite Lord Huster to the city to discuss dower. But if Jaime took the white, he could be near her always. Old Sir Harlan Grandison had died in his sleep, as was only appropriate for one whose sigil was a sleeping lion. Aerys would want a young man to take his place, so why not a roaring lion in place of a sleepy one? "Father will never consent," Jaime objected. "The king won't ask him. And once it's done, Father can't object, not openly. Aerys had Sir Ilyen Payne's tongue torn out just for boasting that it was the Hand who truly ruled the Seven Kingdoms. The captain of the Hand's guard, and yet Father dare not try and stop it. He won't stop this either." "But," Jaime said, "there's Casterly Rock. Is it a rock you want, or me?" He remembered that night as if it were yesterday. They spent it in an old inn in Eel Alley, well away from watchful eyes. Circe had come to him dressed as a simple serving wench, which somehow excited him all the more. Jaime had never seen her more passionate. Every time he went to sleep, she woke him again. By morning, Casterly Rock seemed a small price to pay to be near her always. He gave his consent, and Circe promised to do the rest. A moon's turn later, a royal raven arrived at Casterly Rock to inform him that he had been chosen for the king's guard. he was commanded to present himself to the king during the great tourney at Harrenhal to say his vows and don his cloak. Jamie's investiture freed him from Lysa Tully. Elsewise, nothing went as planned. His father had never been more furious. He could not object openly. Cersei had judged that correctly, but he resigned the handship on some thin pretext and returned to Castle Rock, taking his daughter with him. Instead of being together, Cersei and Jaime just changed places, and he found himself alone at court, guarding a mad king, while four lesser men took their turns dancing on knives in his father's ill-fitting shoes. So swiftly did the hands rise and fall that Jaime remembered their heldry better than their faces. The Horn of Plenty hand and the Dancing Griffin's hand had both been exiled. The Mason Dagger hand dipped in wildfire and burned alive. Lord Russart had been the last. His sigil had been a burning torch, an unfortunate choice, given the fate of his predecessor. But the alchemist had been elevated largely because he shared the king's passion for fire. I ought to have drowned Russart instead of gutting him. Brian was still awaiting his answer. Jamie said, "You are not old enough to have known Aerys Targaryen." She would not hear it.
"Aerys was mad and cruel. No one has ever denied that. He was still king, crowned and anointed, and you had sworn to protect him."
"I know what I swore."
"And what you did."
She loomed above him, 6 feet of freckled, frowning, horse-toothed disapproval.
"Yes, and what you did as well. We're both kingslayers here, if what I've heard is true." "I never harmed Renly. I'll kill the man who says I did."
"Best start with Cleos, then. And you'll have a deal of killing to do after that, the way he tells the tale."
"Lies! Lady Catelyn was there when his grace was murdered. She saw. There was a shadow. The candles guttered, and the air grew cold, and there was blood."
"Very good," Jamie laughed. "Your wits are quicker than mine, I confess it.
When they found me standing over my dead king, I never thought to say, 'No, no, it wasn't me, it was a shadow, a terrible cold shadow.'"
He laughed again.
"Tell me true, one kingslayer to another, did the Starks pay you to slit his throat, or was it Stannis? Had Renly spurned you? Was that the way of it? Or perhaps your moon's blood was on you? Never give a wench a sword when she's bleeding."
For a moment Jamie thought Brienne might strike him.
"A step closer, and I'll snatch that dagger from her sheath and bury it up her womb."
He gathered a leg under him, ready to spring, but the wench did not move.
"It is a rare and precious gift to be a knight," she said, "and even more so a knight of the king's guard. It is a gift given to few, a gift you scorned and soiled."
"A gift you want desperately, wench, and can never have."
"I earned my knighthood. Nothing was given to me. I won a tourney melee at 13, when I was yet a squire. At 15, I rode with Sir Arthur Dane against the Kingswood Brotherhood, and he knighted me on the battlefield. It was that white cloak that soiled me, not the other way around. So spare me your envy. It was the gods who neglected to give you a cock, not me."
The look Brian gave him was full of loathing.
"She would gladly hack me to pieces, but for her precious vow," he reflected. "Good. I've had enough of feeble pieties and maiden's judgments."
The wench stalked off without saying a word. Jamie curled up beneath his cloak, hoping to dream of Cersei.
But when he closed his eyes, it was Aerys Targaryen he saw, pacing alone in his throne room, picking at his scabbed and bleeding hands. The fool was always cutting himself on the blades and barbs of the Iron Throne.
Jaime had slipped in through the king's door, clad in his golden armour, sword in hand.
"The golden armour, not the white. But no one ever remembers that. Would that I had taken off that damn cloak as well."
When Aerys saw the blood on his blade, he demanded to know if it was Lord Tywin's.
"I want him dead, the traitor. I want his head. You'll bring me his head, or you'll burn with all the rest. All the traitors, Rossart says they are inside the walls. He's gone to make them a warm welcome. Whose blood? Whose?"
"Rossart's," answered Jaime. Those purple eyes grew huge then, and the royal mouth drooped open in shock. He lost control of his bowels, turned, and ran for the Iron Throne. Beneath the empty eyes of the skulls on the walls, Jaime hauled the last Dragon King bodily off the steps, squealing like a pig and smelling like a privy. A single slash across his throat was all it took to end it. "So easy," he remembered thinking. "A king should die harder than this. Rossart at least tried to make a fight of it, though if truth be told, he fought like an alchemist. Queer they never ask who killed Rossart, but of course he was no one, low-born, hand for a fortnight, just another mad fancy of the Mad King." Sir Ellis Westerling and Lord Crakehall and others of his father's knights burst into the hall in time to see the last of it, so there was no way for Jaime to vanish and let some braggart steal the praise or blame. It would be blame, he knew at once, when he saw the way they looked at him. Though perhaps that was fear. Lannister or no, he was one of Aerys' seven.
"The castle is ours, sir, and the city," Roland Crakehall told him, which was half true.
Targaryen loyalists were still dying on the Serpentine Steps and in the armory. Gregor Clegane and Aemery Lorch were scaling the walls of Maegar's Holdfast, and Ned Stark was leading his Northmen through the King's Gate even then. But Crakehall could not have known that. He had not seemed surprised to find Aerys slain. Jaime had been Lord Tywin's son long before he had been named to the King's Guard. "Tell them the Mad King is dead," he commanded. "Spare all those who yield, and hold them captive."
"Shall I proclaim a new king as well?" Crakehall asked,
and Jaime read the question plain. "Shall it be your father, or Robert Baratheon, or do you mean to try to make a new Dragon King?" He thought for a moment of the boy Viserys, fled to Dragonstone, and of Rhaegar's infant son, Aegon, still in Maegor's with his mother. "A new Targaryen king, and my father's hand. How the wolves will howl, and the Stormlords choke with rage." For a moment he was tempted, until he glanced down again at the body on the floor, in its spreading pool of blood. "His blood is in both of them," he thought.
"Proclaim who you bloody will like," he told Crakehall.
Then he climbed the Iron Throne and seated himself with his sword across his knees to see who would come to claim the kingdom. As it happened, it had been Eddard Stark.
"You had no right to judge me either, Stark."
In his dreams, the dead came burning, gowned in swirling green flames. Jaime danced around them with a golden sword, but for everyone he struck down, two more arose to take his place. Brienne woke him with a boot in the ribs. The world was still black, and it had begun to rain. They broke their fast on oat cakes, salt fish, and some blackberries that Sir Cleos had found, and were back in the saddle before the sun came up. Tyrion. The eunuch was humming tunelessly to himself as he came through the door, dressed in flowing robes of peach-coloured silk and smelling of lemons. When he saw Tyrion seated by the hearth, he stopped and grew very still.
"My lord Tyrion,"
came out in a squeak, punctuated by a nervous giggle.
"So you do remember me. I had begun to wonder."
"It is so very good to see you looking so strong and well,"
Varys smiled his slimiest smile.
"Though I confess I had not thought to find you in mine own humble chambers."
"They are humbled, excessively so in truth." Tyrion had waited until Varys was summoned by his father before slipping in to pay him a visit. The eunuch's apartments were sparse and small. Three snug, windowless chambers under the north wall.
"I'd hope to discover bushel baskets of juicy secrets to while away the waiting, but there's not a paper to be found."
He'd search for hidden passages, too, knowing the spider must have ways of coming and going unseen, but those had proved equally elusive.
"There was water in your flagon. Gods have mercy,"
he went on.
"Your sleeping cell is no wider than a coffin. And that bed, is it actually made of stone, or does it only feel that way?"
Varys closed the door and barred it.
"I'm plagued with backaches, my lord, and prefer to sleep upon a hard surface." "I would have taken you for a feather bed, man."
"I'm full of surprises. Are you cross with me for abandoning you after the battle?"
"It made me think of you as one of my family."
"It was not for want of love, my good lord. I have such a delicate disposition, and your scar is so dreadful to look upon." Ugh.
He gave an exaggerated shudder.
"Your poor nose."
Tyrion rubbed irritably at the scab.
"Perhaps I should have a new one made of gold. What sort of nose would you suggest, Varys? One like yours, to smell out secrets? Or should I tell the goldsmith that I want my father's nose?"
He smiled.
"My noble father labours so diligently that I scarce see him any more. Tell me, is it true that he is restoring Grand Maester Pycelle to the small council?"
"It is, my lord."
"Do I have my sweet sister to thank for that?"
Pycelle had been his sister's creature. Tyrion had stripped the man of office, beard, and dignity, and flung him down into a black cell.
"Not at all, my lord. Thank the archmaesters of Oldtown, those who wish to insist on Pycelle's restoration on the grounds that only the conclave may make or unmake a grand maester."
"Bloody fools," thought Tyrion.
"I seem to recall that Maegor the Cruel's headsman unmade three with his axe."
"Quite true," Varys said. "And the second, Aegon, fed Grand Maester Gerardis to his dragon."
"Alas, I am quite dragonless. I suppose I could have dipped Pycelle in wildfire and set him ablaze. Would the Citadel have preferred that?"
"Well, it would have been more in keeping with tradition,"
the eunuch tittered.
"Thankfully, wiser heads prevailed, and the conclave accepted the fact of Pycelle's dismissal and set about choosing his successor. After giving due consideration to Maester Turquin, the Cordwain's son, and Maester Eric, the Hedge Knight's bastard, and thereby demonstrating to their own satisfaction that ability counts for more than birth in their order, the conclave was on the verge of sending us Maester Gorman, a Tyrell of Highgarden. When I told your lord father, he acted at once."
The conclave met in Oldtown, behind closed doors, Tyrion knew. Its deliberations were supposedly a secret.
"So Varys has little birds in the Citadel, too."
"I see. So my father decided to nip the rose before it bloomed." He had to chuckle.
"Pycelle is a toad. But better a Lannister toad than a Tyrell toad, no?"
"Grand Maester Pycelle has always been a good friend to your house," Varys said sweetly. "Perhaps it will console you to learn that Sir Boris Blunt is also being restored."
Cersei had stripped Sir Boris of his white cloak for failing to die in the defence of Prince Tommen when Bronn had seized the boy on the Rosby Road. The man was no friend of Tyrion's, but after that he likely hated Cersei almost as much.
I suppose that's something.
Blunt is a blustering coward, he said amiably.
Is he? Oh, dear. Still, the knights of the King's Guard do serve for life, traditionally. Perhaps Sir Boris will prove braver in future. He will, no doubt, remain very loyal.
To my father, said Tyrion pointedly.
While we're on the subject of the King's Guard, I wonder, could this delightfully unexpected visit of yours happen to concern Sir Boris's fallen brother, the gallant Sir Mandan Moore?
The eunuch stroked a powdered cheek.
Your man, Bronn, seems most interested in him of late.
Bronn had turned up all he could on Sir Mandan, but no doubt Varys knew a deal more, should he choose to share it.
The man seems to have been quite friendless, Tyrion said carefully.
Sadly, said Varys, oh, sadly. You might find some kin if you turned over enough stones back in the Vale, but here, Lord Aeryn brought him to King's Landing, and Robert gave him his white cloak, but neither loved him much, I fear. Nor was he the sort the small folk cheer in the tourneys, despite his undoubted prowess. Why, even his brothers of the King's Guard never warmed to him. Sir Barristan was once heard to say that the man had no friend but his sword and no life but duty. But, you know, I do think Selby meant it altogether as praise, which is queer when you consider it, is it not? Those are the very qualities we seek in our King's Guard, it could be said. Men who live not for themselves, but for their king. By those lights, our brave Sir Mandan was the perfect white knight, and he died as a knight of the King's Guard ought, with sword in hand, defending one of the king's own blood.
The eunuch gave him a slimy smile and watched him sharply.
Trying to murder one of the king's own blood, you mean?
Tyrion wondered if Varys knew rather more than he was saying. Nothing he'd just heard was new to him. Bronn had brought back much the same reports. He needed a link to Cersei, some sign that Sir Mandan had been his sister's catspaw.
What we want is not always what we get, he reflected bitterly.
Which reminded him, it is not Sir Mandan who brings me here.
Look, to be sure. The eunuch crossed the room to his flagon of water. May I serve you, my lord?
He asked as he filled a cup.
Yes, but not with water.
He folded his hands together.
I want you to bring me shay.
Varys took a drink.
Is that wise, my lord? The dear, sweet child. It would be such a shame if your father hanged her.
It did not surprise him that Varys knew.
No, it's not wise, it's bloody madness. I want to see her one last time before I send her away. I cannot abide having her so close.
I understand.
How could you?
Tyrion had seen her only yesterday, climbing the serpentine steps with a pail of water. He had watched as a young knight had offered to carry the heavy pail. The way she had touched his arm and smiled for him had tied Tyrion's guts into knots. They passed within inches of each other, him descending and her climbing, so close that he could smell the clean, fresh scent of her hair.
"My lord," she said to him, with a little curtsy, and he wanted to reach out and grab her and kiss her right there, but all he could do was nod stiffly and waddle on past.
"I've seen her several times," he told Varys, "but I dare not speak to her. I suspect that all my movements are being watched."
"You are wise to suspect so, my good lord."
"Who?" He cocked his head.
The Kettleblacks report frequently to your sweet sister.
When I think of how much coin I paid those wretched...
Do you think there's any chance that more gold might win them away from Cersei? There's all...